You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, is Dr. Jeffrey Miller. And you are a professor of evolutionary psychology.
Yeah, that's right.
Author of many books, two of which I've read, one being Mate, you wrote with Tucker Max, and the other, and probably more important book from an academic point of view, is Spent. Hunter called me going, you got to read this book. It's amazing. And I agree. And I will start with this. I'll start with a compliment and then we'll just talk. I love how ambitious the book was because, you know, whenever you talk to a lot of academics, you guys live in a very sort of, it's a very critical world. My God, if you step out with an idea, get ready. Get ready to be, you know, attacked if you don't have all your I's dotted and your T's crossed. And you kind of go out and say, look, man, the way our ancestors grew up in villages and in tribes and with all that support has been lost. We've gained a lot from it, but we've also lost a lot from it. And in some ways, this book feels like not only giving us a better understanding of who we are and why we behave the way we do, why we buy the things we do, but also you kind of offer in some ways not only a different way maybe of looking at human beings based on your work and other people's other evolutionary biologists' works like Gadsad and people like Steven Pinker, but also, you know, kind of offering this notion that maybe there's a bridge. Maybe we can get back to, you know, connection, human connection, and we don't have to be so dispersed, and we don't have to be chasing. I really appreciated the long intro.
Brian, you're famous for those.
I'm the worst at my intros, but I really can't wait to get into your sort of disagreement with people like Milton Friedman, F.A. Hayek, and all the sort of fathers of modern-day consumerism/capitalism/free market ideology. Jeffrey Miller, welcome. Dr. Jeffrey Miller, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be on the show.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Good. So what do you have to say, my friend? Explain to us sort of what you were trying to do with this book, because I think it's important from your words.
Yeah, I think what you said about building bridges is exactly right. I wanted to build bridges first between us and the modern era and our prehistoric ancestors so that we could feel like we come from somewhere. You know, one of the great questions is where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? Where we come from really helps to understand who we are. And so I wanted modern consumers to get a sense of, well, are there really instincts for conspicuous consumption, for showing off, for luxury goods, for paying attention to ads or not? And if there are those instincts, what exact form do they take? What are we really looking for when we do all this shopping and spending? And then I also wanted to help bridge between people, because we try to mediate our social interactions and our mating and a lot of what we do in society through these brands and symbols and luxury goods. And I wanted to kind of strip that away and offer a vision of how we can interact in a little bit more natural way that we're still pretty well adapted to, but most people just kind of don't pay attention to it and neglect it.
Mm. And I always think it's super helpful to think of a few specific examples. So, for example, you talked about why men, like to shop quickly and women tend to spend more time shopping. And I think that's a great example of evolutionary psychology at work in the modern day. Would you mind expanding on that?
Men have this hunting, pursuing mindset, right? We like to chase down big game, yeah. Preferably in groups. And women have more of this foraging, gathering plant foods mentality. So you can see this play out in just how each sex tends to shop on average, you know, how much time they're willing to spend, how focused they are on going for a particular thing on their list versus just kind of seeing what's around and shopping a little more opportunistically.
Isn't that kind of how guys talk too? I mean, we talk about a subject that we want to kind of, we want to kill. You know, it's like, let's talk about F.A. Hayek and consumerism versus this socialism. And it's always like one side is trying to beat the other side down. And that's what we talk about. There's a point. And I find, and I pay attention to how women speak because I'm really in touch with my feminine side. And like,
Brian, are you or are you not wearing lingerie right now?
I can't, it's a leotard. But the point is, I did an episode of Sex and the City, and I decided to watch my episode, and I couldn't even sit through. And I was a big part in the episode, and I couldn't even sit through my episode because I was like, what the fuck are these women talking about? Like, what are you guys just sitting around talking about, like, what he said and what he... I don't give a shit. Did you get laid or not? Let's move on. You know, whatever. They were just so detailed that I couldn't deal... And, of course, my girlfriend at the time went, listen, you idiots talk about statistics when it comes to football and who could beat who up. Please hold your judgment, you moron. You're a different kind of dumb. And it was very true.
That's a pretty good point. Yeah, guys get in debates about geopolitical issues that we have zero hope of ever influencing at any level.
Of course.
But we still think it's really important, like, that we have a view on the Syrian refugee crisis or whatever.
100%.
Do you mean, like, this entire podcast?
Exactly, man. That's why they call it the mother of all podcasts.
But yeah, I mean, even I thought the very specific logic of, like, you know, as a hunter, obviously, you want to kill, get your kill, and then quickly get it back, because if you hang around for a bunch of time, then it spoils. And so in the same way, men want to come in, shop, get what they want, and then quickly get back. But, you know, we think of that classic difference between the sexes, and we don't realize that it's driven by these very ancient, very sort of practical, adaptive biological impulses from 100,000 years ago.
Yeah, so that's one, you know, good little example at the kind of the most superficial level of shopping behavior and just how people move through the space of stores. But even something that simple matters a lot. If you're doing store design and marketing and retailing, you've got to understand those sex differences. And a lot of retailers honestly don't.
Yeah.
They kind of but they don't have a framework. They don't have a theory about it.
Well, and even, like, I mean, the thing that I thought was the most mind-blowing and spent was to understand that conspicuous waste is the goal of how you attract a mate. So could you dilate on the idea of conspicuous waste?
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, conspicuous waste is the idea that throughout the biological world, in literally millions of species of animals, you can show how great you are, how fit you are, how healthy, energetic, what good genes you have by what kind of extravagant ornaments you can grow and display. So the classic examples would be like the peacock's tail, the elk's antlers, the bower birds building these huge bowers to attract mates, anything like that where you have to invest a lot of time, energy, and material into doing something. And a lower fitness rival could not afford to do the same thing. So you're basically saying, look at this stuff, here's what I can do. And implicitly, my lower quality rival can't do it. They can't afford it. They can't create the same ornament or do the same behavior. And you see this played out among competing billionaires buying their luxury yachts all the time, right?
It's amazing.
But even, I mean, the example that I love that I'd never thought of was the bird singing. Like, only a bird that is truly healthy and has more than enough food can afford to spend all day doing nothing but sitting on a stupid branch and singing a stupid song.
Well, how about
all
the elephant
day?
Seal? How about the elephant seal willing to starve?
Yeah.
Willing to starve because the three other things are more important, being a good a badass, protecting his women so nobody else touches them. And keeping his progeny going, you know? I mean, that was fascinating, man. I was like, wow, life sucks to be an elephant seal.
I mean, just think how many calories they're burning if they're getting through 2,000 pounds of fat in a breeding season, an elephant seal.
Yeah, well, that's nuts. I don't have any fat on me, so I don't know what that means, but I'm shredded. I think that's a scientific term. But one of the things that always fascinates me is this notion of conspicuous waste, where I see friends of mine who are educated, smart guys, and they have these impossible cars. They've made some money. And so not only do they have a race car, but they send it to the shop to get souped up so that there's a chip that allows 300 more horsepower. And, of course, they live in L.A., man. So the faster, maybe they might hit 45 miles an hour in a day. And I'm not kidding. And I'm just like, what are you doing, bro? And that's it's a passion. You got to understand it. Is it a passion? Is it they'll spend all day looking under the hood at the engine, at the width. Wheel width is very important. Width is everything. Spokes.
Yeah, but the other thing that's fascinating, again, in terms of the difference between 100,000 years ago and now, is that historically, like, engaging in that conspicuous waste as a man made sense because you could continue to be breeding with lots and lots and lots of different females. In practice, you know, a lot of people by that age are married. So you're mating, assuming that you're not willing to engage in infidelity, you know, your opportunities to benefit from that conspicuous waste are very, very, very limited, but still we engage in the behavior without even understanding that it's pointless.
Yeah, that's a great point, Hunter, that if you lived in an ancient civilization, ancient Egypt, China, Rome, whatever, and you were a rich guy, you would have had multiple wives, multiple slave girls, concubines, you would have had potentially dozens or even hundreds of kids as a result of your wealth. You can parlay your wealth into reproductive success because of the way that those societies are organized. Nowadays, you typically see even Western billionaires having no more kids than, you know, the typical middle-class family. So they're doing all this conspicuous waste and this showing off and signaling, but it's not translating into the basic currency of biological success, which is reproductive fitness and how many babies you've got.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
So it's kind of doubly wasteful in that way.
Yeah, but that's fascinating to me because somewhere along the line, especially in this country, the act of taking lovers if you're married or fooling around, especially if you're a man with other women. And we all know guys do it. Listen, man.
AshleyMadison.com.
Yeah, dude. Well, Leo Flowers said nobody wants 3 Super Bowl rings, 5 cars, 4 mansions, and just 1 girlfriend. You know, ambition cuts all the way across. And he's right in that sense. I mean, but having said that, it is publicly, we've been publicly shamed. I mean, that is just not acceptable. You can't write a TV show. If you're going to write a TV show about your protagonist being unfaithful, good luck. It's really difficult, unless he's a bad guy. But for the most part, unless he's already a mafia don or something like that. Otherwise, you're going to lose your audience, and they'll tell you that right away. When did that happen, and why is that? What do you think that's about?
Well, one interesting exception to that is the TV series Big Love about the Mormon polygamist.
Sure.
Which is actually a pretty good drama,
and the Sopranos,
but it's got to be set in this marginalized subculture.
Yes,
right. Those weird folks in Utah, right?
That's right.
I think, you know, monogamous marriage became the social norm in most successful civilizations eventually, because it does bring benefits at the kind of group level, right? The problem with rich guys having a harem. Like ancient China, they typically had harems of at least 1,000 women. That means 999 guys don't have a woman.
Fuck,
and the emperor does.
Fuck those guys.
And so those guys, losers.
Yeah, losers.
But they get uppity. They get frustrated. And eventually they rebel and they riot.
Yeah.
And bad shit happens. So the societies have figured out, if we can get, you know, the lower class, the working stiffs, the soldiers invested in the well-being of the whole group by everybody agreeing, okay, we're going to be monogamous, those groups tended to do better. At least that's one theory.
That's interesting. Well, share the booty, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, there's actually, there's a book I read a long time ago that was written probably in the 90s, like Gay Marriage, Why It's Good for Us and Why It's Good for Them. And the central thesis that he made was that the central problem for every society is young men. Like young men rape, they murder, they are responsible for most violent crime, mm-hmm. they steal, they do all these sorts of things. And the only way to channel those behaviors pro-socially is to bind them into relationships so that instead those energies are channeled towards building a family, building a home, building all of that sort of stuff, which seems very complementary to what you're saying.
Yeah, I've even seen some interesting estimates recently that a significant portion of China's economic growth over the last 20 years was partly driven by the excess of young men,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of their sex selective abortion that they've had ever since the 80s. There's an excess of young men, maybe 60 or 80 million extra young men, and they have to compete really hard and work really hard and get the money to have an apartment and a car. And if there was an excess of women, they wouldn't have bothered. The growth rate would have been lower.
But how funny is that, right? It's not the Confucian work ethic or any of this stuff. It's simply that there's a shortage of licious ladies.
That's actually fascinating. That makes a lot of sense.
And actually, in terms of the reverse phenomenon, so my Russian language conversation teacher when I was in college always talked about the fact that after World War II in Russia, there was such a shortage of men because so many of them had been killed during the war. And the result was that exactly, the men, you know, were not particularly motivated. They routinely had multiple girlfriends. They would beat the girls. They would drink. They would do whatever they wanted. And it's because you really just didn't have to try.
Yeah.
God, it's so, when we were young and I used to do Taekwondo, and when we would spar, if a beautiful woman came into the studio, I swear to God, we'd always be like, somebody's getting knocked out today. And somebody would get, I swear to God, somebody would get knocked out. The only times guys got literally their bell rung was when it'd be like just some really good girl and we were kicking it for the fences. I mean, we'd just be, because usually if you spar, you're supposed to kind of go, nah, no more. You're not my friend anymore. Yeah, brothers this and brothers that. There's a hot girl there, and it was crazy. It was
so
literally ridiculous.
It was a really funny corollary to that. My dad was in Libya after the revolution, right after the Arab Spring, and they had all of these problems with all these guys shooting their AKs in the air and the bullets coming back down and like landing inside people's skulls and killing them.
Jesus.
And my dad realized, like, the really dangerous thing was teenage girls. Because if there were teenage girls around, you could bet that whatever men were in the neighborhood would be firing their AKs in the air. And so anytime my dad would see, like, a teenage girl, he would run in the other direction.
It's a good signal. It's a good signal.
But even, or, like, do you remember when Jennifer Jacquet was on the podcast?
Yeah, we had this beautiful professor from NYU, I think.
And yeah.
Oh, yeah. I know Jennifer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hunter and I started fighting, basically trying to one-up each other.
Lacking.
We were lacking. One-up each other with how much we knew. It was so sad.
And how closely we'd read her book. Yeah. You know.
I can totally imagine.
You're attractive, but not my type. You know, your hair's just too short.
But you do have that Clooney-esque salt and pepper, which is, you know.
And very curly.
Yeah.
Enough about his hair. let's get back to his brain, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I loved actually Mate with Tucker Max. It was really interesting because I thought I knew everything there was about women as far as being an older guy and having been around. And the way I will say this, you really kind of paint. I was at a wedding and I was around a bunch of NFL football players, some of whom were superstars, mm-hmm. and they were 6'7" and 270 pounds and just all muscle. And after reading that, you know, your book, I thought to myself, that's how women, I looked at those guys and I was like, those guys could do whatever they wanted to me. I don't like it. I have to pick up a knife or do something, but basically they can do whatever they want. That's how women feel in a room full of men, because that was sort of the difference in our size ratio and strength ratio. And for a man who's kind of thinks of himself as kind of macho, it's very disconcerting. It's not a fun thing. I mean, I liked hanging out with him, but it's not fun. And it's made me a lot more aware of how dangerous the world is for women and how sensitive you have to be about when you're kind of looking at them, even if they're good looking or whatever it is. You know, I can totally understand it. From an evolutionary point of view, they've got to get very good at reading male patterns of behavior, because sometimes traditionally their life depended on it, right?
Yeah, their life, their sexual security depends a lot on it. I mean, Tucker and I benefited a huge amount from having done our little Mating Grounds podcast over the last 15 months, which involved a lot of young men calling in with questions, and then we would answer the questions on the podcast. And we quickly realized that one major problem that young guys have is they never do perspective taking. They never ask themselves, what is it like from the woman's point of view? A, in terms of security and risk and anxiety and threats, but B, in terms of what can you actually offer to a woman that she cares about and wants. And even just getting the guys to think about that first threat issue, it's a real uphill battle, because unless guys are spending time hanging around, you know, NFL football players, they never get that sense of what it's like to be chronically physically anxious or even sexually threatened.
Yeah, it's wild.
And most guys know, like, okay, I would be anxious about ending up in jail because I've heard bad things happen in jail. But
that's what they're afraid of. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. I bet you that's the number one fear. When you think about jail, you don't think about the bad coffee and bad food. You're thinking about...
Well, Brian, you do.
I do, actually. I actually do. I'll take the good coffee. I mean, listen, yeah. I'll pick a spot on the wall.
It's so hard to eat paleo in jail,
It's
too.
So hard to eat paleo, man. I mean, dude, it's all carbs. Damn jail. It's fascinating. Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about sort of a new way of looking at human behavior, because we had Maslow's model, but there's a different way of looking at people. It's more nuanced, even from an evolutionary point of view, even from a biological point of view. I mean, and I thought that was really interesting about the book, where you know, and that's a huge part of what we should understand. And then maybe we could talk more about how to bridge the gap between our old selves and our new selves to be more fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, when I teach classes on human emotion and motivation, we talk quite a bit about what's the best framework for thinking about what people really want and what their preferences are. And Maslow had his hierarchy of needs that he developed back in the 40s and 50s. The problem with it is it doesn't really give you any sense of why. Like, what are the origins of these needs and desires? And why do they have the exact pattern that they do? And how do they fit together? And is it really true that we always prioritize, you know, lower level, more basic survival or physical needs over other needs? Clearly not, because, for example, in mating, often young men are willing to take absurd physical risks, you know, like free climbing or riding motorcycles. And why? Because they think it'll marginally increase the chance that some attractive woman might notice them and think a little more highly of them. And guys go like, okay, yeah, I'll ride a motorcycle that's got a 30 to 50 fold higher chance of death per mile than a car, just for that benefit. So I think this is where the evolutionary perspective really helps, because as long as you keep your eye firmly fixated on reproductive success as the bottom line that drives a lot of human motivation unconsciously, it clarifies a lot of stuff that's otherwise baffling mm-hmm. and confusing.
Yeah, and you think that's really the essence of what it's about?
It's sort of the essence functionally, but the way that caches out is we have dozens or even hundreds of different emotions and preferences, you know, that under prehistoric conditions led to reproductive success typically.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays we've still got those emotions and preferences. But there are very few people consciously going around saying, I must maximize babies, right? Or else guys would be breaking into sperm banks to leave deposits.
Exactly.
And women would be stabbing each other to get to be egg donors.
Yeah. I love the way you kind of break down the kind of person that would drive what car. That was fascinating. And just the difference between Cro-Magnon woman and what her life was like, and in a nutshell, and then sort of the average 30-year-old single woman today. And man, yeah. I don't know what I choose in a lot of ways. It really sounded depressing, but you're right about it. You know, there's a lot of despair among people that I travel a lot, and I interact with a lot of people, and I get a lot of emails. And My feeling is that there is a great deal of despair that has come with modernity, that has come with the internet, and has come with being able to speak to everybody whenever you want, how, and having access to all kinds of stuff. But you're right. I mean, we've somehow, I don't know how it happened, we have lost connection, and we've lost purpose for a lot of people. And why do you think people take Prozac and all these antidepressants and watch that much TV? And they're in these jobs they hate. I found myself going, I don't know what would be better. I mean, it was a bleak picture. I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't want to be a Cro-Magnon. That kind of sucks, running from tigers and stuff.
I mean, if you think the coffee in prison is bad,
yeah, I was gonna say.
Cro-Magnon coffee is really
But at
terrible.
Least everything was organic. Yeah,
I can just see Brian out.
These are organic, right? Are these organic?
Brian in Eritrea with the goats exactly. eating the coffee beans.
You're supposed to roast them, I think. Yeah, man. I mean, no, I've spent enough time in the wild hunting four times to know that it sucks and to know that it sucks all the way around. Tell us a little bit more about sort of how you think we can fix this issue. I mean, it's a big question, but, you know, I was sort of really bummed out for that woman, and I think you're right. We're not making friends at work anymore. Somehow, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that we're so caught up with this idea of consumerism, this idea of working really hard so we can get a lot of stuff. And I know that's not a new concept, and I know a lot of people agree with me, but it feels like there are movements to push the pendulum the other way, but we're still kind of caught up in it.
Yeah, I think a good model is actually the paleo movement in terms of ancestral health and nutrition, where the first step is to actually understand, mostly from the anthropologists, what did our ancestors eat, what do hunter-gatherers actually eat nowadays, and then to think, well, we probably evolved to eat that, so maybe we should continue that mostly, and we can kind of play around at the margins with it, but that's a pretty good first approximation for what tends to make us healthy. And then at the social and sexual level, we can ask, how does tribal life work? How did our ancestors actually make friends and interact and attain status and prestige and find mates and raise their kids? Maybe to a first approximation, we should think about structuring society a little more like that.
Communist?
And it's not communist, because you would still have parents and families and their kids. It's just you'd also maybe have helpers, co-parents. You know, you'd have
friends you cared a lot about, and then you
wouldn't actually care much about the folks in the other tribe on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah, I was kidding. You're right. I really do think that we crave that kind of connection and community. I just think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's better for children. I think it's better for everybody. And do you think that we kind of started to go off the rails when people like F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman, both people I've read and very much admire, by the way, but do you think that they had something to do with this idea? That because it feels like they were sort of the libertarian school of, you know, free markets. And in your book, you say the three greatest inventions, I think, are marketing, money, and media.
Media.
So you're not, you know, but somehow maybe you're talking about a balance here.
Yeah, I think there is a balance. I'm a pretty strong libertarian on almost all issues, and I have enormous respect for, you know, classical liberalism and free market economics and all that. A great irony of free market economics is it's actually not very good at explaining conspicuous consumption. I worked in an economics department at University College London for 4 years and would get in these arguments with the economists about, okay, there's preferences and there's utility and there's markets, but how do you explain brands? How do you explain what most people in marketing and advertising spend most of their day worrying about? There's no space in classical economic models for most of that. And it drove me nuts. And I thought, I'm getting along better talking with marketing consultants. Like, they actually care about the psychology of the consumer.
Right.
And most economists don't.
Yeah.
And so I think you can have free markets that operate in all kinds of different ways. You know, you could have a free market that sustained much more tribal level societies or extended families or different marriage arrangements.
Do you think we're kind of moving in that direction anyway? I feel like when I go to cities and stuff, that's not lost on people, right? I mean,
yeah.
You get farmers markets and you've got, you know, this sort of food revolution going on in a lot of places, like farm to table stuff, and you know what I mean? I mean, it feels that way. It feels like people are trying to simplify. It feels like clothing is being more, they're conscientious. I mean, my sheets that sponsor this company, Bull & Branson, sponsors my other podcast, is, you know, the first thing to say is that, you know, there are no sweatshops and this is made, you know, here and all that stuff. So it feels like at least maybe we're aware of it.
Yeah, it's fascinating how many different ways this plays out. You know, the local food movement, guys actually learning how to cook,
grow
the kind of tribal spirit that you get in CrossFit gyms that people adore.
So true.
The the whole MMA culture, for example, is really getting back to some pretty primal aggression dynamics that traditional spectator sports just kind of brush up against but don't really tap into.
Yeah.
That may be their new slogan, by the way. We really get back to primal aggression dynamics.
Well, I have a podcast with a guy named Brendan Schaub called The Fighter and the Kid, which has a huge MMA audience, and he's an active fighter. And I've been pretty close to it, and what's fascinating about that is these men have you're only as good as your team, and the bonds that your training partners and your coaches and all the guys that get into there, and when it's go time and you're in the back room and you're warming up and everybody's really quiet, and then when you come in and you know, I've never seen an exception to this ever. Every fighter will turn and hug 4 or 5 of his teammates who helped him get there, and there is real physical bonding that goes on there. I mean, those are his dogs. That's a dog pack, man. And then he goes in and he puts it out there. But yeah, it's interesting that it is, I guess, one of the fastest growing sports among young men, because it's so technical. There's so much technique involved, but also it's so primordial. It's as close as you can get to watching two people kill each other with their bare hands.
Yeah, and you know, there was a moment in the 90s when legislators got really freaked out about MMA and call it human cockfighting and whatever. And, you know, the libertarian moment was when the fans pushed back enough to say, no, we want the freedom to enjoy this. We care about it. It taps into something emotionally significant to us. And I think if you could see more of that kind of consumer pushback in different domains, people saying, here's the way we really want to live, please let us do that, I think human life would be a lot better.
But I think the other interesting point that you made when we had a conversation earlier this morning, just as a sort of pre-interview without you, Brian, is that, you know, there's really no sort of organizing philosophy or worldview for a lot of this stuff, so that you find that a lot of people are stumbling on these things with the farm-to-table movement or MMA. You know, there is the paleo movement, which is much more explicit about, you know, what are its ideological foundations. But in general, you know, people aren't clear, oh, wait, this is about understanding where we came from, how we evolved, what our impulses are, and then designing and choosing to, you know, work with that basic biology to design a life that is, you know, more satisfying.
Yeah, and I think it becomes pretty transformational. I mean, I've taught evolutionary psychology for 20 years, and when the students finally get it and they realize, here's a set of tools and ideas that I can apply to pretty much any area of my life, it's super exciting for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they haven't really encountered, you know, a theoretical framework like that before that's actually relevant to human life.
Mm-hmm.
Are those the 6 principles you talk about in the book?
There's lots of principles, but those are some of them.
Okay.
Yeah. And I thought the other thing, I mean, and to go back to mate, I mean, so much of what's so fascinating is, you know, once you, I mean, that, you know, normally when you think of these sort of like dating, how to get a girl books, right? It's all, I mean, I don't know if you've read The Game, I'm sure you have, but it's incredibly douchey, for a lack of a better word, because it's all about trying to...
Manipulation, right?
Yeah, manipulation, like you're supposed to peacock and dress in the most ridiculous outfit and like neg the girl, right, to lower her self-esteem so that, you know, she's emotionally vulnerable. And in many ways...
Let me get my pen.
And in many ways, mate feels like the antithesis of that, right? It's about, what you're really advocating is, if you want to meet a great girl, be a great guy.
But also understand how their mind works. Understand why they behave the way they do. They're not being stuck up. They're just, you know, trying to figure out a way not to get raped. Invite you in because you're not attractive. I love that awesome sort of thing. Most men to women are sexually neutral, unless you're gorgeous or you're some special thing. But I've always seen that, where women like, I didn't notice, really? It's like, what do you mean you don't notice? Look at the guy. He's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Oh, whatever. That's my girl.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's particularly fascinating for stand-up comedians that most of them aren't that great looking physically, but as they're on stage for the hour or so,
Yes.
And if they're actually killing it and the audience is responding,
yes,
they magically become more physically attractive to the women in the audience.
Now, I can
like, it's almost like their faces morph from
being disgusting
to being yeah. kind of intriguing, yeah. right?
Well, thanks a lot for calling me disgusting, but I will say that as a regular guy, I can attest to that. When you come off stage, it's pretty crazy. Well, I'm getting older. I'm 48 now. It's a little different, but certainly when I was in my 30s, it was nuts. It was pretty crazy because you're funny, and then you get off stage, and that would be it. Yeah. You know, I never took advantage of that either, ever.
I mean, back to Hunter's point that what we're trying to do with the mate book is get away from the whole concept that guys have to seduce and manipulate and deceive their way past women's defenses, right?
Well, you say it right in the beginning where you say it's not about winning. You know, it's like men feel like there's a winner and a loser in that engagement, right? I mean, that's how we approach things. I thought that was something that I had never even thought about in that context, but you're right, you know?
Yeah, we say you got to seek win-win relationships where both people benefit. It's just like economic trade. You know, you want gains from trade to be mutual. And in the sexual domain, that means you have to fulfill her preferences and she has to fulfill yours. And if that happens and both of your mating goals are aligned, then it's Christmas. Everything's awesome.
Mm.
Well, and if not, you can't really talk your way past the incompatibility anyway.
And the other thing that I thought was fascinating too is just the recognition that the reality is that women's bullshit detection systems are so amazingly beyond anything that we have in our toolkit, because, you know, the threats are so great for them that they have become amazingly good at sorting through that stuff. So if you think that you're going to work your way around these bullshit detection systems, you are wrong, and you are far, far better off like actually being a decent guy.
Yeah, so it's not like if you meet an 18-year-old woman, you think, oh, she's only 18, she's had no experience detecting my bullshit. No, mm-hmm. There's been thousands of generations that have shaped her DNA and her brain and her emotions to detect bullshit from guys generally. And she might still need a few years to get those systems fully calibrated,
right,
so they always work. But there are really good reasons for girls to kind of hit the ground running right after puberty in terms of being very skeptical about male attention.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And one of the other things, I mean, there are so many parts of both these books that I really loved, but the one that keeps on coming back to me is the part in Spent where you were talking about why teenagers are so obsessed with what's cool, why it makes sense to have this window of your life when you are just obsessed with that stuff. And the reason is...
God, I can't remember. Remind me.
where they use words like rad and these things are gnarly and all that stuff. And
they're just consciously watching that all the time. And the reason is to prime them for so that they're learning what are the social cues that matter in my social group. Like, what are the things that when I come of age are going to get me laid,
right,
or allow me to be in a long-term relationship?
If Jeffrey was like, I didn't write the book. I'm an imposter.
Tucker Max has actually written all of his books, and only now is he pretending that Tucker is his co-author.
Somehow I doubt it.
Yeah, somehow I doubt it.
But it's an exciting time because we're learning so much about the brain, and it feels like, you know, I read Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, and, you know, the idea that we weren't a blank slate was heretical, back in the day. I mean, and this is in the 70s. I mean, it was so politically incorrect to suggest that aggression, for example, is inherent. Or, my God, that aggression and murder of one's enemies actually gives you a better chance of getting more women, because women are more attracted to men who have more of a head count. What? That flew in the face of, you know, academia and how our utopian view of the noble savage, quote unquote, you know, that we've been corrupted by modernity and stuff like that. But in fact, it's a very exciting time because we're learning a lot about ourselves.
It is. And once people start learning a little bit about it, they can see so many examples of real life phenomena that fit that. Like, why are so many young male British Muslims trying to get to Islamic State in Syria and Iraq? well, the prospect of actually being able to sexually enslave women is a major draw, and it's something that's ethically repellent, no doubt. But if you're a teenage boy and you're like, oh, I'm frustrated, I can't get laid, where should I go? A place where you can literally buy and sell women. That's...
I had an Iraqi man tell me that he said Yazidi women have always been fabled in Iraq as the most beautiful women. They have blonde hair and blue eyes a lot of times. And he was a Sunni, and he was saying, listen, this is bullshit. That's where the hottest women are. Those idiots are going over there to get laid, and that's what this whole enslavement of these city women is. They were taking them, but that was the area that they were, you know, that people always knew. The Yazidis are their own clan, their own tribe. They're very insular, and this was an opportunity for a bunch of guys to get the fabled, you know, the sirens in the north or wherever they are. It's really
awful. If you actually care about human rights, it's really important to understand human nature and how some of our instincts kind of play out in ways that really hurt other people in highly predictable ways. And if you stick your head in the sand and say it's all a blank slate, millions of folks are going to suffer as a result.
Or if you stick your head in the sand and say something like, well, Islam is to blame or whatever. These are human beings who are in a set of circumstances where a lot of us would behave a certain way. For example, I think a lot of these young Muslim men, like all men, want to feel significant. And in Europe, a lot of them are not included in the society, and they feel disenfranchised, they feel emasculated, they feel all those things. And here's my chance to go off and be a warrior and take my booty. And, you know, as a young man, there's a lot of mythology that is pushed on you, or that we consume, that makes it feel like that's an adventure.
Even pushed on you? I mean, the point is that
it's been all over the idea.
What I mean is that, like, it's, you know, universally around cultures, young men are excited about conquering shit and, like, killing shit and getting booty and getting laid. So it's partly that, you know, the ISIS are a bunch of evolutionary psychologists. They have no delusions or, you know, illusions about what drives young men. And so they're like, yeah. Guns, booty, treasure.
That's why we need men like Jeffrey Miller, Professor Jeffrey Miller, who can teach us the mindset of the enemy.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about soft power here.
Well, it's like Joe Rogan said. Didn't Joe Rogan say that, like, if we really want to fix this country, that, like, women need to start fucking physicists?
Yeah, basically. No, he also said we should just drop a whole bunch of weed on Iraq and Afghanistan. They're just going to get so high and they'll just be like, whatever. It's no problem. You guys are from a different tribe, but it's okay. Dang. Man, come have some fucking food. I'm hungry. Oh, for the world to be that great.
But the other thing that I really wanted to ask you about, Dr. Miller, is you talked about effective altruism, which is something that you're involved with, and I know that Brian's going to love it.
Well, because we talked to David Sloan Wilson about that.
Yeah, but effective altruism, right? Because the idea is that, you know, people engage in, like, conspicuous, like, oh, look at me, I'm such a good person, I'm helping out and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of it isn't actually effective. It's like signaling, right? You're trying to send
the
message.
Like the ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, or whatever it is, as opposed to let's step back and let's understand what is actually going to make a difference and make sure that we're rewarding people socially for doing things that actually make a difference. Is that fair?
Professor?
Yeah, effective altruism is this movement that's really gained a lot of steam just the last couple of years. It's really new. It's mostly young people. It's basically about being really rational and evidence-based about how you do good in the world. And it's being really skeptical about charities and nonprofits that look good but might not actually be doing that much good on the ground in terms of delivering real benefits to the people who need them most. So some aspects of effective altruism are like just evaluating charities, not just in terms of like who's got the lowest percent overhead and management fees, but who actually delivers the most value to real people per dollar spent. Can the charity grow? Can they make use of additional contributions? Is it a charity that looks globally at, you know, all the problems facing humanity in general or even other animals, or is it very parochial and just focused on this country's problems or this city's problems? And it's also a movement that asks people to think really hard about how young people choose their careers. Like, is it actually better to work for a nonprofit, which a lot of millennials think, or is it better just to, quote, sell out, become a finance consultant, and then donate 60% of your income to help others, right? If you do the math, it's usually better to take the highest paying job you can and then donate as much as you can to the very best charities you can find. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of effective altruism approach to sort of career choice.
Oh, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
I knew
much.
You would like that, Brian.
Professor Miller, thank you for you've got more thinking to do, more books to read, write, and read, and more minds to change, sir. So we appreciate you humbling us. With
Thanks
your
for having me
here. It was awesome, man.
Yeah.
Keep doing what you're doing because it's really fascinating. And I look forward to dropping all kinds of tidbits from your book and giving you zero credit for it. All right. Sorry.
Thanks
about
a lot.
That.
Take care.
So, Brian,
thanks,
I'm really excited to hear how you would do that. Oh, I was doing some evolutionary psychology research.
Good friend of mine, Jeffrey Miller, is an evolutionary psychologist, just so I run in that kind of circle.
Oh, okay.
See you soon, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Take it easy.
Bye.
Bye.
That was great. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, another hour or 47 minutes and 18 seconds of brilliance. I hope you learned everything, and we'll see you next time. This is Brian Callen and my colleague, Hunter Motz. My colleague and brain, Hunter Motz, the man who finds you all these people.
I Brian, that's back. So 50s. I really feel like, you know, Walter Cronkite, just like...
Good night and good luck!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.